What is up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the FanCast podcast. We are back from the 2013 Toronto International Film Festival, but we are still talking about it. This is going to be our wrap-up. My name is Eric Davis. I have, of course, joined by Sean O'Connell. We are back in our respective homes to talk about the Toronto International Film Festival. But instead of you know, just reeling off names of movies here that we recommend, we're going to do something a little bit different for our big wrap up. We're going to pick one big movie and one small movie that we strongly recommend you put on your radar. This way, it's easy for you. It's four movies. Instead of 37.
Right. And if you want to hear about big ticket movies like Gravity or August Osage County or Prisoners, we talked at length about those. We definitely recommend all of those films for different reasons. And I think we're going to use this time to sort of spotlight some things that maybe we didn't get a chance to talk at length about, but we definitely want to throw a huge spotlight on because they are titles that moved us for different reasons.
Exactly. And let's start by doing that. So basically, the good thing is that as we started putting these together, all four of these movies are going to arrive in theaters within the next year, I imagine. Two of them very soon, and two of them have just been picked up by distributors, and they will be coming out. So let's start with our big movie. You go first.
All right, I'm going with Dallas Buyers Club, and I know we talked about it in the podcast after we saw it, and we celebrated it because of two outstanding performances, one by Matthew McConaughey, one by Jared Leto, and the more I thought about it, the more I keep, you know, chewing over the material, the more I am so impressed by the ability of this film to get several messages across without going melodramatic, without feeling the need to hammer us over the head with the fact that we're watching a quote-unquote important film. It's set in the mid-80s. It talks about HIV and the AIDS epidemic that was raging through society and this paranoia that some people reacted to when they heard about HIV, and especially the main characters played by Matthew McConaughey, who's just this, you know, rough and tumble Texas engineer who rides bulls, drinks beer, abuses drugs, you know, sleeps with random women, and, you know, his unprotected sex catches up to him. And in his portrayal, in his performance, we get, you know, the textbook actor who drops a ton of weight, and everyone's like, oh, you know, they all try and do that for Oscars consideration, but it's just not that. It never felt like, even though I think it's a movie that the Academy will recognize, it never felt like a movie that was going for the easy Oscar bait label. It has a really interesting story to tell about the FDA and not approving medication that can help people who desperately need it. And it talks a lot about the clinical trials that they do at hospitals where, you know, it could take a year, and some of these people who don't have a year to wait get the drugs that help them, but they might also get a placebo. And so they're putting their lives on the line for medical research that may or may not help them. And I thought that was really striking. And that's before you even get into Jared Leto's character, who is a transgendered female who helps Matthew McConaughey get his foot in the door with the gay community to help them get the medication that they need. And it there's a heartbreaking scene where he confronts his father because, you know, he just wants to do good for people before he loses the time that he has left on this world. And there's so many things going on, and the director knows to just turn this material over to his cast and let them find the heart and the humanity in it. And I thought it did that time and time again. I was so impressed by this movie. I think everyone's going to want to check it out, especially to see the reconnaissance of Matthew McConaughey continue.
Reconnaissance.
He's choosing so many smart roles now and not just falling back on his good looks. And it's a great performance by him. It's a great cast. It's a great story. And I recommend Dallas Buyers Club wholeheartedly.
He is. He's phenomenal in this film. And you know what I like about it is that this was being sold as the film where McConaughey is like, you know, rail thin. But he doesn't start off as this like gorgeous looking man with his golden Matthew McConaughey locks. And then by the end of the film, he's this frail little tiny man. He starts off skinny and ugly.
And gets healthier, yeah.
And actually gets healthier. It's like the complete opposite of what you think you're going to get when you go into it. And it's funny, and that's the point. You know, we see these movies that kind of cover the HIV virus and maybe the beginnings of it and how it goes, and we see, you know, this slow deterioration of people that contradict the virus. Instead, this is the reversal of it, because the point of it is that the medication that they have available at the time doesn't work.
Right.
And so he has to go and find medicine that's not approved by the FDA and kind of bring it into the United States. And this does actually work. And this helps prolong his life from 30 days to years. And he gets healthier. And so it's like the complete opposite of what you expect to see in this kind of movie. And that's what really keeps it engaging for me.
It's just so great that I didn't think – you know, he couldn't have played this movie 10 years ago, because I just don't think as a performer he would have known how to get to all the nuanced little subtleties that help make a fully formed character. He's improved so much as an actor. He's just matured as an actor. A lot of times an actor and a role just land together at the right time, and I think that's happened in this production.
He is, and I hope he continues to at least choose roles that he can explore in a variety of ways. You know, you see certain actors when Oscar starts knocking on their door, then from here on out they're only doing those kinds of movies. Hopefully he still knows how to have fun. I still want to see him do a Magic Mike. You know, I still want to see him, because, you know, in those kinds of roles, he's the most enjoyable to watch.
Oh, yeah, definitely. All right, what's your big one?
My big one is 12 Years a Slave. 12 Years a Slave And this is a really difficult film to watch. It's a film that kind of tests your patience and how much you can stomach. You know, some people have said, is it just emotional manipulation? Do they just put these horrific scenes of people being tortured in this movie just to get a rise out of you, just to make you feel something? And I don't think so. You know, I think it's just such a tremendous film, and it's based on a real life story of this guy Solomon Northup, who's played by Sean. Give me his name because I can't say it.
Chiwetel Ejiofor. I thought it was Chiwetel Ejiofor. Tomato, tomato. But no, I think it's Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yeah, who is exceptional. And he plays this guy, Solomon Northup, pre-Civil War, United States. And he's a free man in New York State, you know, because in the North, they were a little bit ahead of our friends in the South. And he's he's a free man, and he has a good job, and he has a family, and he has a house, and he's very influential up there, and he's talked into going down to Washington D.C. traveling with these two artists, and he plays the violin, and I think he's turned on by artists and creating in that environment, and so he goes down with these two men to play a 2-week gig while his wife goes off on her own mission for 2 weeks to do something work wise, and instead it turns out he's tricked and he's sold into slavery. And he wakes up after drinking and passing out, and he wakes up and he's chained to a wall. And it's those moments, those first moments when he wakes up and he's chained, and he kind of starts coming to terms with the fact that, you know, what's going on here. And he's trying to tell people that he's a free man, and they don't even know what that means. And they're very scary moments, and it just goes from there. He goes down to the South, and he winds up with one plantation owner, played by Benedict Cumberbatch. Then he moves over to another one, played by Michael Fassbender, and it's called 12 Years a Slave because these are 12 years of his life that he is a slave, and he's, you know, alongside some people who really kind of get nasty and dirty, and we see some cameos in there from Paul Giamatti, who plays sort of like an auctioneer for slaves, who's really rough in this. Paul Dano, of course, which it is becoming comical at a certain point because we see Dano just play these disgustingly nasty people in so many movies, and he's really good at it, and he's good in this one too, and you really hate him. Sarah Paulson plays this ice queen.
Worse than Fassbender, who's a satanic person in this movie. She's actually worse.
Oh, she is an ice queen in it. You know, and my biggest I'm the biggest fan of Lupita Nyong'o, this is her debut role. She plays a slave named Patsy, and she has some of the toughest scenes in this film. For a girl, her first movie, she just has incredibly difficult scenes to get by. And you know what? We had this discussion on James Rocky's podcast, The Lunch, and Sean, you at one point said, yeah, it's a really difficult movie. It's a really good movie. There's great performances, but why? Why are we making this movie? Why do we need to see this film? And then I went back to you and I said, you know, as part of my conversation with Lupita Nyong'o, which I have to put up still, you know, she kind of recalled a story from Steve McQueen, from somebody who saw the film, and they told him that they had to go take a long walk by themselves after they saw it, and they kind of contemplated their life, and they contemplated the way they treat others. And I think, like, when you say, why does this movie exist? Why does it have to exist? I think these movies exist because they help us sort of become better people in our lives. That's how I feel. And I think if it gets to – even if it gets to 3 out of 5 people when they leave the theater, if they – I'm not saying they're going to become instantly a better person. But if this film kind of touches them in places that make them go and contemplate who they are and how they treat their fellow neighbor and that sort of stuff, then I think that's why it exists.
Yeah, and I understand that. And I'm certainly not trying to say that you shouldn't see the movie. And I definitely don't want to downplay its effect. In fact, quite the opposite. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized, you know, how, because McQueen is so uncompromising in his vision, that, you know, there are scenes, just specific scenes in 12 Years a Slave, that raise more emotions, you know, than other films in their entirety. Like, there's a point where Solomon, and it's because McQueen immerses you so deeply in the horrific experience of slavery, that when, okay, there's an instance where Solomon is going on a trip to go pick up groceries from a plantation, and he's able to walk, down a path, no one's around him, and he contemplates running. And, like, just the thought of him leaving this path and going into the woods and potentially running brings up, you know, fear and apprehension and hope and terror, because you know that there are going to be ramifications if it fails, but you want him to run. And this is just a 2-minute sequence in McQueen's film, but because he's so masterful as a storyteller, it brings up all of these emotions. And so while you're going through it, it certainly does move you in many different ways. It's just, as you say, it's a very tough movie to sit through multiple times. Like, I can't see, like, getting 12 Years a Slave on DVD and inviting a group of friends over and be like, let's fire it up, it's gonna be a good time, you know?
let's go, guys, drinking game.
You know, as a director and as a storyteller, he makes so many brilliant choices, you know. And you and I see a couple hundred movies a year, you know, and it's, you see lazy storytelling. And so when you get the top choice steak, and it's so wonderful to see what he does, I recognize all that. I'm just saying it was such a tough sit, you know, that the idea of maybe going back and revisiting it for me is difficult to say.
Yeah, and you know what I liked about it? And one thing that I really liked about it the most, and that people have criticized, is, you know, it's called 12 Years a Slave, but they don't put kind of cues on screen to let you know, okay, 1 year has passed, and now we're 3 years later. Yeah. And people have said, you know, that's one of its faults, is that you just have no idea what the passage of time is. And my argument to them is, because neither do these people.
Yeah.
This guy has no idea what year it is or how much time has passed, because when you're in hell, it just is what it is until it isn't anymore.
And it's hell. That's the perfect word for it. Like, I think he recreates a tangible feeling of hell.
Exactly. And he is where he is until he's not there anymore.
Right.
And that's your passage of time. And the title tells you it's 12 years.
Yeah, right.
And that's all he really gives you. And that's what I really liked about it. And that kind of helps you kind of come to terms with the fact of where these people are. And you know, they have no calendars. They're not looking at seasons. They're not talking to each other. Oh, so what do you think? It's March right about now?
Right.
Yeah, you know, there's none of that.
Is it Christmas? Let's put the tree up now.
Yeah, it's just surviving the day.
And
it's just an incredibly powerful movie, and it's a movie that yeah, maybe I'm not gonna watch 3, 4, 5 more times this year or ever, but it's a movie that I will always remember.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And it
totally.
Will stick with me, and it'll stick with me for the rest of my life. So let's go for the small movie. These are movies that aren't, you know, these big, flashy, potential Oscar contenders. These are smaller, off-the-beaten-path movies that you'll still be able to find because they have been picked up by distributors, but they're just kind of smaller films. Let's go with your pick.
All right. This is the last movie that I managed to see in Toronto this year, and it's Jonathan Glazer's film Under the Skin. And it's getting a few headlines, especially because it's been picked up. So it's definitely – you'll see it in theaters. And it's getting attention because it's Scarlett Johansson in a role that is completely different for her. And I think this is what I admired about it. It's different. It's an experiment. You're going to have to go out on a limb, you know, with this one because, you know, yeah, she stars in Marvel movies and, yeah, she's a bankable actress. But, you know, there's very little dialogue from her in this movie, and essentially the premise is she plays an alien who is absorbed a human form, and she goes out on like a 24-hour cycle and just recruits men to lure them back to this house where it's so hard to describe. They're essentially as they think they're going home to sleep with her, and they advance into the darkness of this house, of this room that she has. They keep following her as she walks backwards, but as they walk forward, they slip into this pitch black, murky, just liquid,
like a cocoon type thing, almost.
Yeah. And I think, and we were talking about this before we podcasted, we think that like their essence is feeding some other larger being that we don't see. And that's actually, oddly enough, not relevant to the story even. Like, it's not important that you know what it is. It's kind of just, it's a symbolism of something else. And so I think by the end of the movie that I kind of got what Glazer's trying to say. It talks a lot about how we're attracted to people on a superficial level. And that's where the under the skin sort of reference comes to in the title. And at one point, you know, the character that Johansson's playing wants to sort of experience, like, these guys really want to sleep with me. What must it feel like to sleep with somebody? And when she makes that decision, things go downhill for her. But it's a visually striking movie, and it uses the soundtrack or the score to keep you on your heels and to really unnerve you. It's a lot of like awkwardly played violin strings, and it's a bleak, bleak movie. She's walking along. She's walking around in a European country. Where is she? It's like,
I think she's in Scotland.
Scotland? Oh, right. That's right. And she's constantly just recruiting men who are by themselves. She's always asking, like, do you have a girlfriend? Are you with anybody? And she finds these guys who basically just have nothing else going for them.
You know, what's interesting about that is that the behind the scenes of this is many of these guys were real guys.
Oh, no kidding.
And it was, you know, Scarlett Johansson in this film, she drives around this van where she goes and picks up these guys. And that was really Scarlett Johansson driving around this van. And in the back of the van is Jonathan Glazer and a sound guy.
Okay.
And she's basically – not all of these guys were real guys, but a large majority of them were real guys that had no idea Scarlett Johansson was trying to pick them up. And of course, after they got in the car and stuff, they explained what they were doing and what project they were working on. But so I think that was really interesting. And when you hear Scarlett Johansson talk about it, it was this exhausting process of driving and driving and picking up these guys, and I'm sure she was nervous because she had to play this character.
Right. But what I love about it, though, what I really admire about it is that Scarlett Johansson's reached a point where, you know, she's got Marvel money. You know, she doesn't have to do these experimental projects. She could coast on playing Black Widow, you know, forever. But it really does seem like if she believes in a project and she really taps into what the director wants to do, she's going to keep challenging herself. And there's another component of this, which we haven't brought up, which is the fact that, you know, she's nude a lot.
At least four different occasions. She's fully nude.
But it's not it's just time to do my nude movie. You know, it's for the plot, yeah. and it's a strange plot, but she totally believes in it. And, you know, the weird thing is that people are going to hear like, oh, my God, it's the Scarlett Johansson nude movie. And they're going to go to see it like for that reason. And they're going to be sucked into a really strange head trip of a movie. But I hope that they wake up to the fact that there's a lot more going on and that Jonathan Glazer is a inventive and, you know, risk taking filmmaker. Because he did Birth before this. He did Sexy Beast, which is a great movie too. And this is another really good film to put on his resume.
Yeah, I really like kind of what it says about the nature of sex and why we're attracted to people and how damaging it could be.
I'm sure she thinks a lot about that too, you know, because like for her, her looks have been a bit of a commodity as she's been – and she's become a much better actress too. So I would love to read about like what her thoughts are, because it is a lot about how people are just really attracted to what you look like and not don't care about what is going on inside of you.
No, and how damaging that can be with the final results. Okay, so moving on, my small movie is going to be one called The F Word, which – is The Friend. It's in The Friend is the F word. And this is a really sweet little romantic comedy starring Daniel Radcliffe and Zoe Kazan about two – I mean it's a really basic premise. It's about two friends who are friends. And she has she's living with another guy, and he's a nice guy. And she meets Daniel Radcliffe at a party. He's best friends with her cousin, who's played by Adam Driver from Girls. Okay. If you like Adam Driver in the show Girls, he plays a very similar character in this kind of unpredictable friend who's just all over the place, and he's got a girlfriend that's just as unpredictable as him, and they're just like, you know, we'll lick each other's faces in the middle of a restaurant, you know. But Daniel Radcliffe is a lot more reserved. He is British in this, but, you know, it's nice to see Radcliffe after Harry Potter do a lot of work. And all different movies, all different kinds of films.
Right.
And it's really sweet to see. I feel like we haven't seen him in this kind of just romantic comedy. And, you know, these days we don't get a lot of romantic comedies that we recommend to people. They just aren't – they're a little bit too cookie cutter. They just don't really feel genuine. What I love about the F word – is that it just feels completely genuine. The conversations that they have with each other feel like conversations that friends have. And I like how it really kind of dances that line between loving someone and falling in love with someone. And, you know, When Harry Met Sally is the ultimate can men and women be friends without sex becoming a problem, this isn't as – it isn't going to go down as iconic as that one. But it has a lot of interesting things to say about being friends and moving on from that. And I really dug it. You know, Michael Dowse, who directed it, his last film was Goon, which I loved. I loved the hell out of Goon. I think it's, if you haven't seen Goon and you're any kind of hockey fan, even if you're not a hockey fan, track that down and watch it. It is a dark, darkly funny comedy that I just love. This one is a lot softer than Goon, but it does have a lot of really great comedy and a tremendous amount of creative poop jokes, which I really respect about it. Because you know what, it's almost a cliche. Oh, what is it? It got a poop joke or two. This one has some extensive poop jokes. Ongoing poop jokes.
See, I want to see it just for that. Like, now you keep selling me on the poop jokes, and yeah. Now I'm fascinated to see how they pull that off.
And they're creative, and they're used in different ways. Some advance the plot, some are just one-offs, you know, and it's just really – I dig that about the film. I'm like, all right, you're going to go for the poop jokes. They go for it. They really go for the poop jokes. It's just a sweet film about sort of finding the right one to love.
So I'm bummed that I missed it, because it is getting really good buzz. And I've been claiming Emma Watson is going to be the real breakout of the Harry Potter trio, because she's been doing really interesting work in movies like The Bling Ring and Perks of Being a Wallflower. But you think Radcliffe can survive the Harry Potter, you know, shadow? You think he'll have a career outside of it?
I think we're still watching. I think we have to see. The F word is a big one for him, because I feel like since Harry Potter, he's kind of done these smaller ones. He's done a thriller. He's done like a biopic. He's done these sort of smaller movies that not a lot of people are seeing. I guess they're movies that don't appeal to the Harry Potter crowd. Okay. I feel like the F word is a film that will appeal to that crowd, will kind of appeal back to that teenage into young adulthood fan base, female centric. And I think it speaks to a lot of people in their 20s that are sort of finding their way and trying to find true love and to kind of notice that. And so this is an interesting role for him. Okay. It's, can he be that guy? Can he be the guy in the romantic comedy and kind of compete against, you know, the Zac Efrons of the world?
And remember, Eric, you don't want to be that guy in the PG-13 comedy.
You don't want to be that guy in the PG-13.
You want to be that guy in the R-rated comedy.
Yeah.
And I'm quite sure.
Exactly. You know, and Radcliffe is dorky and funny and sweet in this film. And if I had to ask something of him, I want to see him to kick it up a notch in another. I want to see him in another comedy, but I want to see him in a dirty comedy. And I want to see him, you know, this one definitely is dirty in a lot of ways, but I want to see him kick it up a notch. I do appreciate the fact that he's trying it all. He's going from genre to genre and seeing what sticks, and I like that. He's not sticking with anything in particular. And Zoe Kazan, who I'm not a huge fan of.
Right.
She's got a little bit of that manic pixie dream girl thing going on. She's like she's like the next Zoe Deschanel in some ways. But she's good in this too. She plays the girl, and she does a really good job at sort of balancing that. I'm committed and I'm in love with my boyfriend, and what I like about it is that her boyfriend in this is a nice guy,
right?
You know,
right.
He's a good guy. He's got a good job, so it's not like, you know, the entire movie you're rooting for her to get away from this scumbag, you know, because she's with a nice guy. She's in a good relationship, and so that dynamic is really interesting. And it's shot all over Toronto, so if you're a fan of Toronto movies and films shot in Toronto, then hey, this is all yours. But the good thing about the F word and Under the Skin, A24, who did Spring Breakers, they did The Bling Ring, they just picked up Under the Skin.
Okay.
And then CBS Films has picked up the F word. So both of these films, these smaller movies, are going to come out at some point in the next year. We don't know when. I feel like Under the Skin is a good winter movie.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
That's a good February movie, because I can't see that really
it's
competing.
Bleak.
Yeah, it's bleak. It's cold. It's dark.
Right.
It's a good February movie. I'd like to see A24 put it out then. Definitely.
How sad was that scene of the kid left on the beach?
Oh God, I couldn't deal with it.
I was ready to cry. Now it seems like both of us were really moved by actors, you know, going outside their comfort zone and trying new things. All four of these movies that we singled out are really about performers, you know, thinking outside of what we normally expect from them, and I think that that's fantastic.
Exactly. Yeah. I think there's a lot of really tremendous performances coming up. That are from unlikely actors and actresses, and which is what you want to see. You know, you want to see some of your favorite actors and actresses taking chances like that. You know, 12 Years a Slave, Michael Fassbender, who I was lucky enough to go meet at a bar here in Toronto, and he, you know, he looked like Fassbender, the best looking guy in the world, wearing a leather jacket, just the epitome of cool. But in this film, he is the ugliest I have ever seen this man. He is a despicable, disgusting human being in this film. And I said to him, mano a mano, I said, man, I don't know how you went to those places in this film, but God bless you for being able to go there and give us that kind of performance, because that sort of stuff has to take so much out of you. And so these people kind of stepping outside what we usually see of them and taking a chance on material that maybe their fan base doesn't think that they should be taking a chance on. So it's nice to see that.
Well, and there's a lot of other under-the-radar titles that we couldn't get to today. Things like Young and Beautiful, things like Blue is the Warmest Color. We both saw The Double and really liked it a lot. So this was a great year for film in Toronto, obviously. I think going into it, I was a little bit hesitant. There was a lot of titles that skipped Toronto and, you know, things we have to sort of wait to see in the next coming weeks, whether it's the Coen Brothers' new one or Captain Phillips or All is Lost. There are big titles still coming, but I think we were really happy with everything that we saw. I think of the 18 movies I saw, you know, 15 or 16 of them were truly great. And I had like one or two whiffs. And so that's a great ratio by any standard. And I hope that we did a pretty good job of covering what we were able to see and get you guys excited for some of the movies that will be coming to theaters in the weeks and months to come.
I hope so too. Sean O'Connell, it is of course been a pleasure covering the Toronto Film Festival. You, this was my first time at the Toronto Film Festival, and I had such a great time. And being able to kind of run out of these films and go and sit in a corner in a press office and talk about them with you was a really great experience. And so thank you for that.
Of course.
Now we move on. Now we get into fall, and we start, you know, covering more stuff and podcasting about big things and Star Wars and films coming out in theaters and Marvel, and it should be fun. Thank you very much for listening to these Toronto Film Festival podcasts. I'm going to link to all the rest of the ones that we did in case you missed any of them in the post for this one. And feel free and go back and listen and download and have fun and listen to these on a way to work and write down these titles and keep an eye out for them because we're recommending some really great movies.
That's right. Leave us comments. Leave us any questions. We'll try to address anything you guys want us to touch on. But, you know, we'll get around to all these other films as they come out. Gravity, Rush, Prisoners, those are all on our immediate radar. You guys will be able to experience them soon without having to travel all the way up to Canada to do it. So maybe you guys are the lucky ones. But we had a blast. It was so much fun being able to just sort of, like you said, dissect these films. And I can't wait to go see a lot of them again and kick them around some more.
And if I didn't leave off on one final note, one final Canadian note, it would be thanks very much for listening to this podcast, eh? And we'll talk to you again next week.